A note that this service is being recorded, and the entire service recording will be available on the password-protected member page on our website. Our prelude this morning is You've Got a Friend in Me, written by Randy Newman and performed by Ron Fry.
So this may be a familiar song to some of you, and you're welcome to join me if you want. And I'm doing one later that has the words in the order of service, and you can certainly join me there, if not here. You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me. When the road looks rough ahead and you're miles and miles from your nice warm bed, you just remember what old Ron said. Yeah, you got a friend in me. 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 You got troubles, I got them too. There isn't anything I wouldn't do for you. We stick together, we can see it through. 'Cause you got a friend in me. You got a friend in me. Some other folks might think they're a little bit smarter than I am. Bigger and stronger too, maybe. But none of them will ever love you the way that I do. Oh, it's me and you, kid. And as the years go by, our friendship will never die. You're gonna see it's our destiny. You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me.
Thanks so much. Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I want to extend a special welcome today to our guest speaker, Dr. Hasimi Traore. Whether you're connecting via Zoom or here in person, we are one community today, united in love and purpose. My name is Ann Pryor. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I've been a member of Prairie for 30 years. I had to count them up. I started out as the director of religious education in 1988 and became a member after that in 1995. My two daughters grew up attending Prairie. I've been a board trustee, the chair of the Religious Education Committee, and I'm currently the chair of the Committee on Ministry and the editor of our monthly newsletter, The Prairie Fire. So to welcome you, we welcome all of you to our service, especially those of you who are searching for a spiritual home. Many of us were once too, seeking for something larger than ourselves to which we could belong. A sense of rootedness to hold us as we create meaning together. We do that well here, although not perfectly. In this congregation, we strive not for perfection, but for authenticity and connection. Whether it's your first time with us or your 100th, we hope that you'll find here questions that stretch you, people to befriend you, and values that challenge you to join us in loving boldly, living justly, and welcoming openly. Our chalice lighting today is read by our pastoral minister, Mary Sue Rudebeck.
Good morning. I am Mary Sue Rudebeck. My pronouns are she, her, hers. This poem was written by one of my favorite authors, That's my other favorite author. We'll hear from him later. But this is Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. If I were not African, I wonder whether it would be clear to me that Africa is a place where the people do not need limp gifts of fish, but sturdy fishing rods and fair access to the pond. I wonder whether I would realize that while African nations have a failure of leadership, they also have dynamic people with agency and voices.
Our opening music today is number 16 in the Gray Hymnal, "'Tis a Gift to Be Simple," accompanied by Carlene Tyszynski. Please rise in body or spirit. Today's story for all ages is Wangari's Trees of Peace, a true story from Africa by Jeanette Winter, read by Mary Sue. Youth and adults who want to are welcome to gather up here in the front to listen to the story. And afterwards, we will sing our youth out. And the lyrics for that are in the order of service.
Good morning. I was talking to Karen, and she said that you may have heard this story before. Do you remember it? So,
yeah.
Okay, wonderful, wonderful. You've heard it. So I'm gonna have you help me tell this story, okay? I'm gonna leave in different places for you to put in the words, but this is a story of a woman who lived in the Kenya area, and her name is Wangari Maathai. Can you say that? Wangari Maathai. She was a courageous person. What does it mean to have courage?
It means that you're brave and you stand up for others, even if they're
your friends. Oh, that is the best definition of courage I have heard. To stand up for others, even if they're not your friends, right? And that's hard to do sometimes, isn't it? And that does take courage. Do you do that? I bet you do. Okay, so we'll start her story. Wangari lives under an umbrella of green trees in the shadows of Mount Kenya in what continent?
Africa.
She watches the birds in the forest where she and her mother go round to gather firewood for cooking. And she helps harvest the sweet potatoes, sugar cane, and maize from the rich soil. Wangari shines in school. And when she grows tall, like the trees in the forest, she wins a scholarship to study in, where do we live?
America.
Okay. 6 years later, her studies were over, and Wangari returns to her Kenya home and sees a change. What has happened? She wonders. Where are the trees?
Wangari sees women bent from hauling firewood miles and miles from home. She sees barren land where no crops grow. And where are the
trees?
And who lives in those trees? Birds. So we can't have, there's no place, no home for those birds. Thousands of trees have been cut down to make room for buildings. But no one planted new trees to take their place. Will all of Kenya become a desert? She wonders. And what happens when we feel really sad? How many of you ever cry? Do you ever cry?
I cry,
yes, and she cried. Wangari thinks about the barren land. I can begin to replace some of the lost trees here in my own backyard, one tree at a time. She starts by planting tiny seedlings. Have you ever planted a tiny seed? And does it amaze you how tall, how big it gets? Yes. You planted a sunflower. It started small, and then it got very big. Then it died. That happens. Did you plant another one? Maybe this year. Watching the seedlings take root gives Wangari the idea to plant more. To start a farm for baby trees, a nursery in an open space, she plants row after row of the tiny trees. And what happens when you start to do something good and you keep at it and other people see you? What happens? They might want to do what?
The same thing.
They might want to do the same thing. They're like, well, if she's got the courage to do this, I can do it too. Next, Wangari convinces the village women that planting trees is a good thing. She gives each one a seedling. Our lives will be better when we have trees again. You'll see. We're planting the seeds of hope. Of hope. Hope is active. It takes us getting busy. The women spread out over their village, planting tiny seedlings and long rows, like a green belt stretching over the land. The government men, they laughed at her. Women can't do this, they said. It takes trained foresters to plant trees. The women ignored their laughter, and what did they do? They continued to plant. They just kept on going. Wangari pays them a small amount for each seedling still living. After 3 months, their first earnings ever. For some of these people, that was the first time they had received money for their work. Word travels, the wind rustling through leaves about the green returning to Wangari's village. Soon, other women in other villages and towns and cities in Kenya are planting rows and rows of trees. Does it look like a desert now?
No.
No, there's beauty. But the cutting continues. Wangari stands tall as an oak to protect the old trees still remaining. We need a park more than we need office towers. She let them know her thoughts. The government men disagreed. Wangari blocks their way, so they hit her with clubs. They call her a trouble maker, and they put her in jail. And still she stands how? Tall and proud. Right is right, even if you're alone. But Wangari is not alone. Talk of the tree spreads over all of Africa. More women hear the talk and plant even more seedlings in longer and longer rows. The seedlings took root and grow tall. And now there are over 30 million trees. That's really good, isn't it? That's good. Did she do it all by herself?
No,
she had friends, right? Friends who believed in it and got busy.
Yeah.
But Wangari is not alone, right? So then more women hear the talk and plant even more seedlings in longer and longer rows. The seedlings took root. The umbrella of green in Kenya returns. And you know, it's still there, isn't it? It's still there. Women walk tall. Their backs aren't bent anymore. They're walking straight. For now they can gather firewood closer to home. That land is no longer barren. And because of her work, there are people, women and men, who are working for a greener Kenya. The whole world hears of Wangari's trees and of her army of women who planted them. And if you were to climb to the very top of Mount Kenya today, you would see the million of trees growing below you and the green Wangari brought back to Africa. So this book is available if any families would like to borrow it. I'm happy to loan it. And you can talk and learn more about Wangari. Thank you. Yes. Yes, you may borrow this book and then I'll get it back from you. You can take it when you go back and then we'll share it with other friends. How does that sound? All right. We will sing you off to learn.
Let us now join our hearts and enter into silent meditation. I will ring the chime again at the end to end this time of silence. Our presentation today is The Power of a Promise by Dr. Hasimi Traore and Mary Sue Roydebuk.
Good morning again. Today I have the privilege of introducing you to a very dear friend, an inspiring humanitarian, and one of the best people I have ever had the privilege to know, Dr. Hasimi Traore. Hasimi was born in Burkina Faso in the town of Dedugu. Although Burkina Faso is rich in culture and beauty, it also has one of the highest poverty rates in the world. In spite of this, Hasimi graduated high school, a privilege reserved for only the top 5% of students from his hometown. And because he was at the very top of his class, Hasimi was chosen to receive support offered by a very generous Canadian family. When he graduated from high school, he received a government scholarship to attend Burkina Faso's Math and Science Institute, where he earned a bachelor's and master's degree in math and chemistry. While earning his degrees, Hasimi also worked for the Peace Corps. And because he had a friend, a good friend in the Peace Corps, who was also a colleague, was attending graduate school in Iowa City, he encouraged Asimi to go there. So Asimi used the money that he earned working with his Peace Corps friends to buy his plane ticket. He applied for graduate schools and was accepted at every one he applied for in the United States. While Asimi, he graduated with a PhD in chemistry in 1995, he began teaching chemistry at UW-Whitewater. And after that, he continued to, he started an NGO, or a not-for-profit for Burkina Faso, and he's been teaching in Whitewater for 29 years. He also recently completed a master's degree in peace studies at UW-Milwaukee. Asimi, can you tell us a little bit about coming from Burkina Faso as a young man and then landing in Iowa City, Iowa? What was that like?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you and thank Prairie.
Put the microphone closer.
Okay.
Yeah,
can you hear me?
Yes.
Well, I would like, first of all, to thank you so much for inviting me here, and I'm very happy to be with you today. So coming here, it was really difficult. But one thing is, when I graduated from the University of Burkina Faso, and I was working with Peace Corps, and my friend Jeremy from Burkina Faso was a graduate student at Iowa, but one of the Peace Corps volunteers is the one who really excited me to come. But when I applied, I was accepted at Purdue, Tulane, Maine, and Iowa. But he was from Iowa. His parents live in Cedar Rapids. And he told me, oh no, go to Iowa because other places are too cold. There was no place colder than Iowa. Where I come from, the coldest it gets is 50 degrees. And when I arrived at Iowa, in Iowa City, it was below zero. I was wondering how people could survive. So, and then I start to learn how to put warmer clothes. And first of all, the English was not my official language. I speak Burkina Faso language, I speak French. So taking classes in English, it was very hard. And also, I was a teaching assistant. So I don't know how I was going to teach math in English, but I decided I have to survive. It's like they sent from me in the jungle, and I have to manage to get out. So I was doing my own tutoring in my room, you know, try to pretend I am in front of a student, and I was speaking to myself and to improve my English. So when I get to my classroom, and it was hard for the student, but they were so kind and accept me. And then for instance, I didn't know how to say my toes, or I said the fingers of my feet. And they were smiling and said, no, no, we say toes. So I was learning English through my students, and the food also was complicated. The first time I discovered Burger King, I thought it was the best food on the planet. Every day when I get to Burger King, I was asking for a Whopper. So then they've given me a nickname, Whopper Man. When I get to Burger King, they call me, oh, be ready with the Whopper because the Whopper Man is here. And all this, the thing really make me happy and energetic, it was people were really nice. The people were not mad at me or angry at me, they accept me. In my department, I received help from my colleagues, my friend teaching assistant, and it gave me a lot of hope that I am in a place that I can succeed. And the math department was very nice, but I tried to translate all my math classes into French, which didn't make any sense. But with my friends, classmates, we were discussing, and it was hard. And the thing I survived also is because when I left my apartment, so I found a TV in front of someone's house. Then back home, if you have an oldest TV, you never throw the TV away. So I wait in December, it was getting dark, and around 6 p.m., I walked by the same place when I saw the TV, when I decided to pick it up. And when I get closer, I saw someone from, in front of the where the TV was, and I went to the house, I knocked at the door, I said, can I take a TV? They said, oh yeah, you can take it, it doesn't work, only the sound. I said, okay. I pick up the sound, the TV, I went to my apartment, I turned it on, I could listen, so to some show, and then a few weeks later, I was walking, I saw in a dumpster another TV. I pick up, I went home, I turned it on, but the image worked, the sound doesn't work. Well, I put on the top of the other one, I had a whole TV. So I was watching wrestling, I thought it was real, I was excited. And there was a show on TV, I will never forget, Nightline. Every night I was watching Nightline because I like to watch the news. I want to learn, I want to see things. So those helped me, to improve my English and also my student. And after a year and a half, I received my master's in applied math. Then I transferred to the chemistry department and I get my PhD, then I get hired at Whitewater.
Asimi, in my 25 years of knowing you, I have seen you do amazing things with such grace and deep love for the people who are around you. And I've been inspired by many of those acts of kindness. However, the one that will never leave my heart and that of many was your story and your fortitude to bring the first ambulance to Burkina Faso. Could you tell us a little bit about your childhood and also what inspired you to keep that promise of bringing an ambulance to Burkina?
All right. My childhood was difficult because when I was born, less than 1 year, I lost my dad. I never met my dad. It's still hard for me because I want to know him. I want to ask him questions. I have a lot of questions I would like to ask him, but I didn't have a chance to ask him. So his best friend had a lot of kids, almost same age with me. His best son has four wives. That's the way it is in a polygamy family. And his best friend took me as his child. And every day when I get up, I go to his family, I had fun. And only one day when I was ready to go to school, and I went for the first day of registration, and they asked me for my last name. I said, my last name is Koulibaly, because his best friend's last name was Koulibaly. They said, no, your last name is not Koulibaly. The last name is Traore. I said, how come? This guy is my dad. They told me, no, it's not your dad. I went home, I asked my mom, who's my dad? And then he told me the story about my dad, which, it was very difficult for me to know, but I never knew who's my dad. But I still think that to see my mom struggling for me, and it gave me courage. And also, my mom was helping also my friends, because when she was going to the flea market, he was selling donuts, peanuts. If she was making $1 a day, I was a happy boy. I could eat at least one meal. And when I saw him struggling, I said, no, the only thing I can do is to succeed in my life, to help him, to help her. I was only 6-7 years old. And I was on Sunday, I was carrying her goods, taken to the flea market, help her sell all the stuff. And then I was lucky enough, so when I was in junior high, a Canadian family just wrote a letter to my principal. They want to help a child who's a good kid, but he doesn't have money. And my principal gave my name. And I was receiving sometimes $20, $10 a month, sometimes $50. And guess what? It turned everything for me. I was happy going to school. My friend who were in difficult situation like me, they were coming to my house, we were eating together. I was playing soccer, volleyball, all the sports you can name except swimming. I was doing everything. And in my class, I was a top from junior high to high school. And I was really happy. So when I get to the university, I wrote to the family, I said, you know what? Thank you so much for all your help. Now I am at a university, and I want you, the help you give it to me, if you can, to give to another child, which they did. And then they never seen me, except we write to each other and sending pictures. Until when I arrived in the United States, I call them, I say, hey, I am here in the United States. I am at a university. They say, wow. They said they will send me a plane ticket to come to visit them in Montreal. I told them, no, I don't need money to come there. I will come by myself. I took a Greyhound for the first time in the United States, the second time, from Iowa City all the way to New York, 36 hours Greyhound. And then they were waiting for me at the border. So when I arrived, they took me to their house. They couldn't believe it. First of all, they were shocked how tall I was. I told them it was a surprise. I didn't want them to know my height. And I had a wonderful time with them. Then I went back again, many years, and until both of them passed away. So that's those briefly, what I went through when I was a child.
And during that time, you encountered a situation that was difficult and that you made a promise that you kept. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. One thing I forget to add it also, when I was in elementary school and junior high, back home, even today, so you go to school around 7 o'clock, you have to come back at 12, you go back at 3, and then you come back at 5. So I was walking 12 miles a day. It was hard, and also, I didn't speak French. I had to learn French at school. And if you get caught in a schoolyard speaking your native language, you'll be in trouble. So that was a very difficult. And then one day, my father's best friend child, he was in 10th grade. He was like my older brother. I like him so much, he was protecting me. And he was riding his moped going to the market. I was riding a bicycle, I borrowed a bicycle from someone to help my family to buy something at the flea market. When we met, he raised his hand, say hi, and then suddenly I hear a noise, boom! And I turn around, he was hit by a car. And he never survived. And when I saw that, I was 12 years old. And they tried to take him to the donkey car, to take him to the hospital. And it was hard for me to see it, because there was no ambulance to take him to the hospital. And I talked to myself, I say, one day, I'm gonna buy an ambulance to bring to my hometown. And I didn't have money to buy at that time. When I get to the University of Burkina Faso, I couldn't buy an ambulance. When I went to Whitewater, one day I was driving from Whitewater to Stoughton, I saw an ambulance parked in front of someone's backyard. I stopped by, I took a phone number, I called the owner. Then he said, wait for me. And I waited for him. We get into the ambulance. I told him, you know, I'm interested to buy the ambulance. He said, what am I going to do with the ambulance? I told him the story. The ambulance, the price, it was $6,000. When I told him the story, he said, no, he was going to sell it for $5,000. So, well, I didn't have $5,000 cash in my hand. And I was paying slowly until I finished to pay. And then I didn't know how to send it home because it was very expensive, more than $6,000. When I told the story to Mary Sue and as a friend in the campus, oh, they said, no, you will take that to Burkina Faso. Well, you remember you did fundraising, a whole community did fundraising for me, and we had more than $10,000. And they told me, oh, you can take it, the ambulance, to Burkina Faso. I said, no, I don't want to go by myself. I want to go with my student who helped do the fundraising, the community, and the university. So six of us went to my hometown, and we delivered the ambulance. Even today, the ambulance is still running. One day I was talking to my family, I could hear the noise. They say, oh, is this your ambulance? I said, no, this is your ambulance. And then when I came back, the Ryan family read the story in a paper, newspaper, and they called me and said, hey, we have another ambulance for you. And then I went, it was on the TV here, and they gave it to me. But this time it was hard to go back and ask people for more money. So I decided to pay myself to send the second ambulance, and the second ambulance is running. Just to tell you, in my hometown area today, when I grew up, it was only 10,000. To today, it's more than 80,000 living in this area. So, and the ambulance is still running, and a pastor sent me an email. I will never forget that, because they took him from with the ambulance going to a very long distance to a second largest city to save his life. And so that was really the reason I did the ambulance. Then I get a third one, I bought it, and I sent it by myself because I was able to save some money.
Asimi, that story still lives on in the white community, white water community, and with many others. I know for me, just the journey that you let us be a part of that. And I know you just returned last week from a trip to Burkina Faso. How did you find the conditions now there?
Well, Burkina Faso now is a different place for me because when I went, I found that in 2015, the jihadists just almost, I would say, invade Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger. They're killing innocent people. Just in December, we went to a small town, not my town, in the north, near the capital city. They massacred 600 people. The only thing they want to do, they want to change everybody to Islamist. Well, my father and my mother were Muslim. I grew up in a Muslim family. I went to Arabic school. I used to speak Arabic. I pray 5 times a day from 12 years old until 24 years old. I was doing that. But when I see now, everybody is scared. When I was in the capital city just a week ago, I couldn't go to my hometown because down the road, the jihadists can charge and the transportation and kill all the people. I would say if I traveled in my home country, somewhere I could get killed because it's not secure. It's a very difficult situation. There are a lot of reasons this happened. is because now Burkina Faso and Niger and Mali are forgotten country. People are dying every day. Even today, once I was reading in Mali, they kill innocent people. But my father came from Mali and moved to Burkina Faso. So life is very difficult. Poverty, a lot of refugees, children. You drive your car by the street, you can see abandoned kids. They're asking for money. They're asking sometimes for $10. And when I was driving from my place to visit my niece, I stopped at a stop sign. There's a guy who asked me only for $30 to save his brother who was in a moped, sitting behind him on a moped. I couldn't believe. I checked in my pocket, I had $80, I give him $80 to go and buy a prescription to save this young man's life. So life is hard. But people have hope. When you land in, at the airport, you see people, they still are resilient. They think that things can change, and also believe that things can change. So I'm helping as much as I can. I am sponsoring a hospital, giving money to buy milk for children, and I had 3 scholarships, and I give to elementary school, high school, and university student to help them. But one day that, you know, they also will help someone else. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Thank you, Simi.
Thank you so much. That was really interesting and powerful. Now is the time that our community dedicates for discussion around the focus of today's service, relying upon our covenant of good relations as a guide to ensure that all voices are welcomed and relationships are valued. We have until 10:55 for discussion, about 10 minutes. As you approach the podium, please watch your step near the microphone cord, form a line on either side of the room, or raise your hand to receive a microphone. Introducing yourself with your name and pronouns is welcomed. For those on Zoom, please raise a virtual hand and unmute once called on. Or you may type into the chat to have your comment read out loud.
Hi, I'm Randy Converse. Thank you both for your efforts and for your courage, sir. I have a political question. The jihadists, is it your guess or understanding that they're mostly folks of your country, or are they just armies that coalesce and come and take over other countries? Does that make sense? I'm just curious. You know, they say they want to take over and change everybody to Islam, but my sense is they legitimate their work because the people are poor and they're trying to help the people. And I'm wondering, just based on your conversation, it sounds like just a bunch of political people who want to take over. And they're not really residents of Burkina Faso and they want to do better for their folks.
Oh, that's a very good question. I wish I have a whole session to talk about the jihadists. One, because when I was doing my peace building, I did a presentation about jihadists. But there are 2 kinds of jihadists. One, unfortunately, this one is true. When Obama was in power, the president of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, and one of Muammar Gaddafi's son has a nerve to say on TV, on the radio, that his father financed French president campaign, which is against the law in France. Right now, he's on court to respond to that charge. So Gaddafi, for many people in the United States, is considered as the worst president. But he did bad thing, but also he helped his country. So he controlled some of the jihadists in the southern part of Libya. So when he get killed, now those jihadists in the southern part of Libya move to Mali and Burkina Faso area to have a free land. And then they start now to fight for their goal. They almost invade Mali, but until the French president sent some military to stop them. That was another president, not Sarkozy, that was Hollande. So now, because they occupy some territories, they are using young people from Burkina Faso. They pay them $600 at least a month to take a guns and kill their own people. So the two types of jihadists are the one coming from Islamic States or Al-Qaeda, and the local one who receive help, financial help, to fight their own country. And second, I will also blame the African government, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, because when you want to develop a country, you don't just help people in the south. You go and help people in the north, because it's where they don't have anything. In fact, even today, some of them eat leaves from the trees, cut the leaves from the trees, and try to feed themselves. So we need to help the young men, you know, who don't have anything. It will help to stop at least the jihadists, because Burkina Faso and Mali, they are killing 100 a day. But when they kill 100 today, 200 will show up. So you cannot spend all the time killing. So you have to find a way not only to develop economically the north part, and also to start a dialogue with them to help stop the war.
Hi, Kent Wenger, he, him. This isn't so much a question, but just sort of a comment that I have this very tenuous connection, because my sister majored in French in college, and as a result of that, she was in the Peace Corps in Togo, which, for people who don't know, that's another West African country that has a border, like a small border with Burkina Faso. And if I recall correctly, when she was there, which was the late 80s, I think there was some political tension between Togo and Burkina Faso, or else Togo and Benin, I'm not sure. But anyhow, she had this experience. And she was in the northern part of Togo, so actually quite close to Burkina Faso. Yeah.
Yes. There is always a small tension between countries, especially when the governments are different. If you have a military power, in Burkina Faso we have a military government, young men of 34 years old. Unfortunately, we have the same last name. So in Mali, there's a military government. Sometimes there's a tension, but today, I think Togo and Burkina Faso are best friends. Yeah, but don't forget, the jihadists still, now they're in the north of Burkina Faso, now they come down here, so the jihadists are in Togo now, they're in Benin, in Ghana, they're killing innocent people there too, so.
I'm Dori, she, her, and I just wanted to say thank you so much for your talk. And I think the reason a lot of people are not talking today is that our hearts were touched so deeply by what you said that we almost don't know how to respond. But I think if you look at this group, we were really deeply moved by what you said. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, ma'am. Thank you. I really appreciate it. Yes, for you to have compassion for people of Burkina Faso I represent today, I think it means a lot to me. It means a lot. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Asimi. Thank you for this time.
Okay, all right. I had a logistics question. Who drives the ambulance, and how far from your hometown is the nearest hospital?
Oh, first of all, before I sent the ambulance to Burkina Faso, I drove an ambulance from Wisconsin all the way to Baltimore to ship it. And guess what? I supposed to get there around 7 a.m. the next day, so I lost my break in Cleveland. But I managed to get there. So, and then from Burkina Faso, what's happened is I hire a driver and like a nurse, a retired nurse, so they can drive the ambulance. It's not a lot of money. I pay $50 for the driver and $100 for the nurse, so per month. Then they can help bring the sick people to the nearby hospital. Well, the hospital, it depends. If it's in my hometown, it's just maybe 5 to 10 miles. But if it's in Bobo-Dioulasso or Ouagadougou, it's more than 200 miles. Yes.
Thank you. I snuck my question in. I took advantage of presiding. So now, thank you again so much for that wonderful presentation, both of you. Today, we are sharing our offering this quarter with the Catalyst Project, a mutually supportive community for single mothers and their children who have experienced homelessness. Our offertory music is Help Somebody by Susan Warner, performed by Ron Fry. Follow along with lyrics on the back of the page.
You may remember we've done this song before in other services in the past, and if not, the tune ought to come to you pretty easy. Got plenty and then some, what do I do? Got plenty and then some, what do I do? I got plenty and then some, what do I do? Go out and help somebody, get plenty and then some too. I got a roof over my head, what do I do? Got a roof over my head, what do I do? Got a roof over my head, what do I do? Go out and help somebody, get a roof over their heads too. I tried to work in the word ambulance and it just doesn't go easily. Got supper on a table, what do I do? Got supper on a table, what do I do? I got supper on a table, what do I do now? Go out and help somebody, get supper on their table too. Cause I got it to give, I got it to give. And when you got enough to give away, that's the only way to live. I go into heaven, that's what I do. I'm going to heaven, that's what I do. I'm going to heaven, that's what I do now. Go out and help somebody get it to heaven too. Thank you.
Thanks, Ron. Our closing words will be read by Mary Sue Roydebook.
This poem was written by the great South African author, Dennis Brutus. There will come a time there will come a time, we believe, when the shape of the planet and the divisions of the land will be less important. We will be caught in a glow of friendship. A red star of hope will illuminate our lives. A star of hope, a star of joy, a star of freedom.
Our closing music is number 6 in the Gray Hymnal, Just As Long As I Have Breath, accompanied by Carlene. We have a few announcements today. Today after the service, the Prairie's Parents Youth Group, Prairie's Parents Group, PUPS, is meeting. Families will enjoy lunch together and then parents will meet upstairs for a discussion. Next Sunday service is Exploring Love Languages, led by Mary Sue Vroidebuck. Mary Sue will look at love languages outlined in the book, The 5 Love Languages by Dr. Gary Chapman. The service includes a chocolate meditation. And Barbara Chatterton has an announcement about our annual spring auction.
Hey, everybody. I've got some exciting news. Prairie's annual auction is just 1 month away on Sunday, March 16th. Our fundraising goal this year is $11,000. This is one of the biggest, most fun fundraisers we do all year. It's your chance for taking home some delicious homemade goodies, pack your calendar with fun events and gatherings. Finally, get help with those tasks that you have been putting off. And the best part? Every bid helps support Prairie and keep our community thriving. But an auction only works if we have things to bid on. So it's time to start thinking about what you might donate. Maybe some baked goods or handmade items, a few hours of yard work or babysitting, a dinner party, tour or game night, or anything else that you love to do, teach a skill, host an outing. Get creative. Submitting your donation is easy. Just use the link to our auction website found in the weekly email or use a paper form found on the hymnal cart. And of course, we need bidders too. Can't make it? Find a friend to bid for you. Is there something from a past auction that you'd love to see again? Use our display board in the lobby to make a suggestion. So mark your calendar for March 16th and start brainstorming your donations and get ready for a day of fun, surprises, and community spirit.
Thank you. And there are more announcements in your order of service and the News of the Week email. At this time, we are stopping the recording.